Welcome to Radio at Firehouse.com. Real issues, real answers, real firefighters. Firehouse.com brings you the leaders of the nation's fire, rescue, and EMS services, the top columnists and educators, and today's most important issues, headlines, and comments. Listen right on your desktop or download and listen on the go to Firehouse.com.
With less money and fewer firefighters, departments have to use their people in the smartest and safest ways. So the next time you're speccing an apparatus, think manual and remote control monitors. Why, TFT practically reinvented radio frequency handheld controls for monitors, flowing from 15 up to 2,000 gallons per minute. Since every firefighter counts, so does every purchase. We can help maximize your team's Firestream's performance today. Visit us at www.tft.com or give us a call at 800-348-2686.
Welcome to the Apparatus Architects with Mike Wilbur and Tom Shand, and we're very fortunate today to have a guest, Captain Dave Ogden from the Syracuse, New York Fire Department, and we'll be getting the captain in just a few minutes. Mike, with what's been going on here in industry-wide and as well as some of the things happening out on the fire service side, anything you want to mention here before we launch into the formal part of the program today?
Yeah, Tom, I have just a couple of quick headlines and notes. In Nashville, Tennessee, news out of Nashville, a fire truck that had flipped over, the engineer had requested that the tires be replaced on the truck before it obviously flipped over, and now that incident is heading to court in Anmore, Oklahoma. Carter County commissioners and area fire chiefs are arguing over the color scheme of the county's new fire trucks. The new trucks are painted white with orange striping trimmed in black, but one of the local fire chiefs told county commissioners that most fire chiefs in the county want the trucks painted red to match the rest of their fleets. Local fire departments usually decide the color scheme on their vehicles, no matter the source of the funding for the vehicles. But still, the county commissioners voted 2-1 to keep the paint scheme white with orange striping and black trim. And then finally, it's a sign of the times, and it's kind of a sad sign. As our listeners may recall, there was a fire truck accident in Riverside, California, that killed a firefighter about 2 years ago. And this case has been rambling through the court system. The driver was indicted for that death, but was ultimately exonerated. And the lawsuits have been been swinging around. And now the widow of the firefighter that was killed is now suing Spartan Motors. She filed a wrongful death suit against Spartan Motors after the 1987 Spartan fire truck hydroplaned off Interstate 10 near Beaumont, ejecting her husband. Why did her husband get ejected? Because he didn't have a seatbelt on. And I think this just goes a long way to really emphasizing the need for us to take personal responsibility for our own personal safety. Obviously, no amount of money is going to bring her husband back, but yet to sue an apparatus manufacturer because your husband failed to wear a seatbelt is just ludicrous. It's just ludicrous. That's not the way that we should conduct ourselves. But in any event, we trudge on. And you have a guest for us this morning, Tom?
Yeah, it was Captain Dave Ogden from the Syracuse Fire Department. So for our listeners, a background on the good captain has been with the Syracuse Fire Department for 30 years, spent 10 years on the line as a firefighter and as a apparatus operator, and for the last 10 years has been the Assistant Apparatus Maintenance Superintendent. That's pretty long title there, but what that means on a day-to-day basis, Dave's in charge of overseeing the apparatus repair, a lot of the rehab work that they've done there in the Syracuse shops, fabrication and replacement. He's also been responsible for overseeing the pump and aerial testing for all of their fleet of units, and Dave takes this not only seriously on the job, but also in his spare time, like most of us. He's a New York State certified EVOC and pump operator instructor, New York State municipal fire instructor, and both my brother Mike and myself have spent a fair amount of time in the volunteer service. Dave's been with the Sentinel Heights Volunteer Fire Department for 25 years in Onondaga County and spent 16 years as chief of the department. So we welcome Captain Ogden to the program today. And so just one thing before we launch into our first little barrage of questions to the captain. Mike, just following up on a couple of things that we've talked about in the previous podcast. They're talking about the cost of units and things in a national fire apparatus paper that circulated throughout the country. There was finally an article written by a well-known person with a pump background, Gary Handwerk, that identified all the different things that the new 1901 standard is going to talk about. And maybe if we have some time with Captain Ogden, we can get into that as well. And listing out the different components, and first time I've seen somebody actually put down in print what Michael and I heard down at the show in Baltimore was what the cost of all of these things are going to be on a new rig. And according to Gary Handwerk, his price tab on this is a little over $8,000, which kind of goes along with some of the numbers that Mike and I were heard being thrown around. But the one thing that really got me is in this one particular publication, they always have these nice fancy pictures of fire trucks, and I always kind of turn to that centerfold first and look at the rigs. But in this publication, they list the sale price of all the units. And this one particularly got me, Mike, is that a unit that well-known manufacturers advertise very heavily in the digital, in the national publications, including in our own Firehouse magazine, is a rescue pumper, and it describes all the fine little features. And for a surprisingly affordable $553,246, you two can back one of those things into the Wilbur Firehouse. And it just kind of struck me that in looking at the prices of a lot of these vehicles, I mean, the average median price almost anymore of a rescue engine is well over $500,000. And if there's anything that Mike and I have gotten hit with over the course of the last couple of weeks is some people commenting just in general, just, you know, where's the apparatus industry going and how much longer are we going to be able to afford these rigs when a, quote, average pumper starts over $400,000, and as soon as you put some things on it to do a multitude of jobs, you're over $500,000. So I don't know what your thoughts are there, Mike, but that one kind of struck me. It's nice to advertise the Cadillac, but when you see that it comes with the Cadillac price, it kind of makes you wonder a little bit.
Yeah, it surely does, Tom, and many of the prognostications that we've done over the past couple shows just seem to be coming true. As our listeners recall, we were pegging the new NFPA changes to come in somewhere between the $8,000 and $15,000 mark, and it looks like it's ended up at the low end, which is good for everybody that needs to purchase a truck within the next 24 months. But one of the things that we talked about in the last podcast about rehabbing fire trucks with the cost of this equipment escalating almost on a monthly basis, it's just not going to be affordable for many fire departments. And if any of our listeners out there have money they want to invest in something, invest in a business that's going to rehab fire trucks, because I think that before we buy new, many people are going to be looking to rehab current models that they have just based on the new cost estimates and the new cost of this stuff. It's who would have ever thought in our lifetimes, you and I, Tom, that just a nominal pumper would be over $400,000. I remember the first custom pumper that we bought for Otisville, New York, was $49,900 from Hahn back in 1974. And so we here are 34 years later, and that same truck has escalated to over $400,000 for just a nice custom pumper. And like you said, any kind of rescue or hazmat capabilities or anything, and we're well over $500,000. And then when we get to the aerial devices, $1.2 million for a truck. You know, imagine going in And even for the city of Syracuse, imagine going into the city council and, you know, we need to replace four aerial devices. And by the way, I need $5 million to do it. That's some tough stuff.
That's a good point, Mike. And maybe put the start out with Dave's comment on this. You know, for a number of years, the city of Syracuse has had a well-documented apparatus replacement plan. And following up, going back to the very first time that I drove into Syracuse when I was a youngster right out of college in December of 1972, and just being mesmerized by what the department was purchasing, you know, back then, and then because they were doing under former Chief Tom Hanlon's plan to reduce the number of companies overall, where I believe they went from 18 engines at one time, they even initially went down to 14, and now you're running 10, and had 8 ladder companies, and now you're running 6. The plan was build new stations, buy all new apparatus, so they were doing what Mike and Tom have kind of pledged against here over the last couple of years, is, you know, you don't buy your apparatus like bananas. You don't buy them in a bunch. But that's exactly what Syracuse did back in the 70s to implement this radical new program, and they successfully been able to replace the units on a very timely basis. So, you know, Dave, I guess the first question we've got for you is, you know, 30 years on the job. I think when Brother Mike got on the job in New York City, they were still raising that spring-loaded wood aerial, and that's probably what got him acclimated to wanting to be that ladder guy that we've come to know and love. But over the 30 years that you've been on the job in New York, I mean, how have you seen the apparatus design change over the years? And with your current position, now that you're looking to maximize that amount of in-service time so these rigs are not constantly being down for all these, some of these electronic nightmares that occasionally we hear about, you know, how do you see this in your opinion? Has our reliability gotten better with the current model rigs, or, you know, if you go back to the early part of your career, do you think we were actually in better shape back 20 or 30 years ago?
I think 30 years ago we had mechanically controlled engines and transmissions, and sometimes not even an automatic transmission or a gasoline engine instead of a diesel engine. And a pump was a manual stagecoach lever type pump shift, so that if the thing got there, you were going to get it in pump and it was probably going to put the fire out. A lot of times they didn't go back to the firehouse with us because they had a mechanical failure or breakdown of some kind. Today, I believe, even with all of the additions of the interlocks and the emissions and the electronics, as far as the guy in the street, the guy with the boots on, I don't think he sees a great difference. And if he sees any difference, he may be that the vehicle is easier for him to operate, is more user-friendly. The hard part is in the shops, I think. The mechanics have to be electronic technicians today. They have to be able to read a multimeter and an ohmmeter and chase down millivolts and just take the time to go through the chart, repair chart, to figure out what's not happening. In order to put them guys in the shop, usually they have to have a pretty good amount of education, and, you know, unfortunately in that line of work, they're still paying on a scale that's much lesser than the education requirement today. The days of wheel end mechanics and component changers, I think, are history. Components are much better today. We have very few component failures. It's usually 99% of the time it's a ground wire or a bad wire end or a wire that's got a little corrosion in the end of it or has gotten into the casing, where somebody else has just poked their test light in it and made a hole in the insulation. And then, especially in central New York, we use that liquefied truck disintegrator on the roads during the winter to keep the ice and the snow down, and it just plays heck with the electronics. But as far as the firefighters using it, I think they're much friendlier, and I think they're much safer than they were when we started. You know, they almost everything that we have now that goes down the road has four doors that open and close and keep the guys in there. because they don't wear their seat belts, although that's something that, I know we've all been trying to address for years and years. Such a simple operation that they should be doing that second nature. But the doors are becoming a problem for us because of the nature of the firefighters. As the guy that can slam the door the hardest is the winner. But the doors don't. If the door doesn't work correctly, or if the firefighter is, in our case, we've had a couple of guys that have fallen out of the vehicle, and almost. Thank God we've had no serious injuries, but almost have been run over by their own apparatus and. The first phone call from the chief to me is always, well, call up that manufacturer and ask him, you know, how come tell him the door popped open. And I tell him, I says, well, I could do that, chief. But the first thing they're going to say to me is, well, did he have his seatbelt on? Well, the obvious answer to that is no. So in a maintenance standpoint, doors have to be 100%, or they're going to have to go into a spare or not use that side of the vehicle or something. They can't. We can't trust them to wear their seatbelts, so if the door's not working properly, then they can't use that apparatus. We have a lot more creature comforts today, air conditioning, and power steering, ABS brakes that make their life easier. But from a maintenance standpoint, it's something you have to stay up on.
Dave, a couple of interesting points that you made. One with respect to, you know, the education level of the mechanics. And I know with my side of the business on the manufacturers, the individual dealerships, that's, I think, one of the single biggest things that they wrestle with is to locate and find good technicians and then to keep them employed. Because I think the adage is, if you're, and I'm not, as most of our listeners know, between Mike and I'm not a mechanic by trade. I've done hundreds, if not thousands, of pump tests. I could do a pump test and tell you what's wrong with the vehicle, but you could push up behind me the world's most expensive set of Snap-on tools, and I'm clueless. You know, I can't disassemble the pump, and I can't fix it. But trying to find a technician, and in municipal service, I'm thinking where you've got potentially more regulated, stringent pay grades based on what work level the fellow's at. I know out in the private sector, good technicians are hard to locate because if you're on your A game and you're doing a good job, you're employed. You don't find these guys working the food line at the McDonald's drive-thru. So have you had difficulty, you know, in recent years of being able to keep and secure mechanics, or you know, what have you had to do, if anything, to address that need to not have a guy maybe use the shops as a training ground and then go out to go work in the private sector where arguably he could probably make more money?
I think that as far as acquiring help, yeah, we have a city residency rule also, and I've found throughout the years that a real good emergency vehicle technician wants to work on them during the day, but he wants to be a vol somewhere at night so he can play with them. So if you make them live in the city and they can't belong to a volunteer organization. So that cuts that avenue down. The best technicians I've seen out in the county or out in the private sector, it's either if you're real good, then you guys are like vultures after them, and they go from place to place, or else they start their own business if they're really hot. We acquire mechanics that have heavy equipment experience, and then it's a training process, and it's a continuing process with the OEMs and the component manufacturers, the local parts suppliers will put on clinics, and some of the electrical people will put on clinics for the guys, and so they're constantly learning. The thing that keeps them with us is that we are a municipality, that we pay them a few dollars less than they could make in the private sector, but after 25 years, they have a retirement, they have vacation, they have sick time, they have medical and dental benefits, so the package is there. Historically, in our shops, we've always acquired mechanics that are over 40 years old, with very few exceptions, because they've worked that flat rate time and they've made good money, and they've seen the economy go up and down, and then you know, they get an offer to say, okay, you come here, and we're going to work you, but we're going to take care of you, and we're not going to go out of business as they see other places. Or most of the mechanics that I have workplaces that have gone out of business in this area and moved out. So that the stability of working for the city of Syracuse and the working conditions, we've done a strive for the last 20 years to improve the shop, and I think they've got a really nice work environment, and we support them. I don't ever tell them, you know, I don't ever make them put something out that they're not comfortable. If they do, then I'm going to be uncomfortable. So when it leaves the shops in Syracuse, it's right. Even if it takes a day or two longer, because we're not under that productivity, got to get it out. We have the luxury of having 3 spare suffin aerials and 5 spare pumpers and a spare first response vehicle. So it's basically an ongoing education. You guys change things on us. Every time we get a new apparatus, some engineer somewhere sat around and said, hey, let's try this. So we've seen that come and we've seen that go.
Yep. I guess for our listeners, the benefit of maybe he was not aware of some of the real rich history in the Syracuse Fire Department. Back in the early 70s, you mentioned that he's now deceased, but a very, very innovative and progressive fire chief, Tom Hanlon, when the New York State mandated a 40-hour work week for fire and emergency personnel, it really turned a lot of departments upside down because they didn't have the ability to just summarily go out and hire additional firefighters to offset the fact they were going to be working fewer hours. So Syracuse developed in the fire service circles what was known as the mini maxi concept, which was a mini pumper in the day in the 70s was a 10,000-pound GVW international chassis that had a steel cab, aluminum body, a 300 GPM power takeoff driven pump, 200 gallon water tank. But what differentiated that from the overused mini pumpers that you saw in later years was how it was set up from a tactical standpoint, in that it had 2 pre-connected cross lays. It had carried 700 feet of, at the time, 3.5-inch supply line, which was an unusual size, at least for the upstate New York area. And it had a remote control monitor made by Santa Rosa. And that was combined with the maxi pumper, which was a 2,000 GPM unit with a 500-gallon water tank, 4-inch-and-3-quarter cross lays, also carried a remote control pre-pipe monitor as well as a portable Stang gun, which that's a device that was very common, is used extensively in New York City in the 70s and 80s. But then most importantly, it carried a 50 or 55-foot two-section articulate telescopic water tower made by a bunch of different manufacturers. So that kind of brings us to, I think, one of the unique things, Dave, that you have in Syracuse is that where Mike and I have gone out and traveled in some communities and, you know, found that, you know, again, in a city of your size where you've got 10 engine companies and 6 ladder companies, and found that, you know, they never bought from the same guy twice almost. You know, that you look at the fleet and it was almost the A to Z fire apparatus fleet that you folks have had the good fortune of operating a fleet that's largely been a mixture of rigs through the years, but at one point you had a number of Pierce apparatus with a Hendrickson cabin chassis, and in later years, you know, had some E1s, a couple of Salisbury units, and now you have a fleet that has a number of Miracle of France units with the Telescort device. But I think most significantly, and this is interesting to me, and Mike, you're bringing on this, is that, you know, a lot of people are debating what if they're going to buy an aerial device, what's the best aerial device to build, and people take sides, and it's almost like, you know, having ball team rivalries. And if you look at it in Syracuse, you folks have over 35 years experience of running not only mid-mount aerial devices, you know, aerial towers, but you've operated in very successfully, and they've all been Sutphin. So one of the unique things that the Syracuse Fire Department and Captain Ogden oversees is the fact if your ladder company apparatus is out of service for preventative maintenance or for whatever, and you go out of that, and it's a first-line Sutphin, you're going into your spare unit, and it is the same make, same manufacturer. It may have a few little different idiosyncrasies, but what benefits, Dave, has that been that you've seen from the maintenance side, as well as maybe if you could speak to, because I know you kind of have to oversee as the companies get new apparatus and you have to train the personnel with both the factory delivery folks and your training division, which is next door. What advantages do you see by, you know, by having that standardization from those perspectives?
The standardization is, of aerial devices is critical to us. For crews to even be able to relieve each other at the scene of a large fire, if we brought a crew in as a relief shift and put them on a different, from a different truck company, say we have to relieve truck one at a fire, we bring truck two, the guys getting off of truck one can just get on truck two and drive that back to the firehouse and function after their rehab. And the guys that came in fresh can just climb on the truck that's already positioned and working there and man that, and they know the vehicle. One of the things we don't have to do very often when we switch apparatus out in one of our truck companies is to tell them how the vehicle operates, or, you know, this one doesn't go into PTO this way, it goes into PTO this way. They're pretty much all the same, and even though they're all Sutphins, we still, in our spec, have required Sutphin to remain pretty much the same over the years. So a Sutphin maybe that somebody else buys is just a little bit different than the one we buy, because we want them to be the same. Parts-wise, of course, there's less parts inventory because there's less, you know, this is a sole manufacturer. A lot of the parts they use have remained the same for years and years and years. We had the luxury in the past to maybe buy two or three at a time. We're down to one now, but because of the monetary expenditure. But
Dave, you hit on something just there that Tom and I continually preach, and you talk about a sole source manufacturer. What benefits do you derive from that?
From sole source?
Yes.
I consider sole source is that when I buy the Tom Shan fire truck and it gets to my firehouse, and I don't care whose chassis is under it or whose pump is in it, when I have a problem, I'm going to call Tom Shan or whatever manufacturer provides it. In the past, that hasn't been the case. Especially with our mini pumpers, we put them on an international chassis. Although we didn't buy the chassis, the manufacturer bought the chassis. He did his thing, but then it came time for service or warranty work. Well, I'll take it to the international dealer. Well, I don't want to take it there. I want you to fix it. It's your problem. Then, if they subcontract out their warranty work, then that guy is caught in the middle, and somewhere along the line, the problem is going to be in a gray area, whether it's the OEM of the fire apparatus or the OEM of the chassis. That causes a maintenance nightmare. We went through that in the past, and so right in our spec now, we want it to be a sole source provider. So sole sourcing, it relieves the end purchaser, the fire department, from the nightmare of trying to run down the warranty work or the repair work, or if the OEM hooked up something wrong especially today, into the commercial chassis wiring harness incorrectly. Especially if you're a small department and you don't have your own maintenance shop, will relieve you of. It will make your life extremely easier.
Yeah, Dave, that's a very good point. I mean, sometimes people utilize that terminology of sole source as a marketing ploy or something to put in the specifications to maybe scare another prospective bidder away. But what Captain Ogden just described is really where the rubber meets the road there, proverbially, is that when you have a problem, you want to be able to call one person and frankly not get the old, I don't know whether it was an Abbott Costello, or we're dating myself now here, or an old Marx Brothers routine where everybody just ran around and pointed at somebody else and said, not my problem, it's yours, you know. So at any rate, that's a pretty interesting perspective here. One of the other things, we'll handle this one and then we'll take a short break. With the impact of just the rising cost of diesel fuel, you know, everybody that fuels up their car, no matter what grade of fuel you're putting in there, or if you happen to be somebody running around in diesel-powered whatever, that just the increasing cost of fuel and some of the higher expense for repair parts. What has that done recently, Dave, to your operations in the shops, knowing that in a city you're operating under some pretty tight budgetary constraints where you're establishing the budget in many cases maybe over a year out in anticipation of doing certain things? What impact has that had recently on operations at your end or maybe out in the field with the apparatus with these costs?
Right now, we really haven't, because of the city government, and to say that they're working from behind all the time, I guess is correct. I know that their fuel budgets are hundreds of percent over from what they had budgeted for this year, and I think they're all just scrambling at the higher government end to try and cut costs. But over the years, Syracuse has done a real good job of cutting costs and cutting waste. So we're kind of down to the point where, you know, you just kind of gotta do it, gotta bear it. There's probably some point in the future where we're going to stop doing safety inspections, home inspections, that we're going to stop doing vacant building inspections, and every Sunday we go out and everybody goes out and does an Opticon check throughout the city. And we might, instead of taking the aerial or the pumper out, we may make the first response vehicles do that. But right now we haven't run into that. The place where that has really hurt us is that we project our vehicle purchases on a 5-year projection, and as of last July at this time, the price of a pumper was nowhere near what it is now due to energy costs in general, just for the iron and the aluminum and all that's involved in energy. That our projected figures that we presented to the city are way out of line. They're way low now, so that we have to go back to council and say, you know, we need more money just to purchase a apparatus. And with the 07 engines and the costs incurred there with the emissions and the price of energy to produce the vehicle, it's just, that's immediately is a problem for us.
So, Dave, with your system, is, if Mike and I understand it correctly, then is when you go to submit the budget for the capital expenditures for apparatus, this is something that gets derived and worked up within the fire department, but then you've actually, maybe not yourself, but somebody within the fire department administration actually has got to present themselves in front of the city council and, like, sell this program and explain it. Is that correct?
Yeah, that we leave that up to the chief, you know. That's his, you know, we're like a kid, you know. This is what we'd like. This is how much money we think it's going to cost you, and okay, when are you going to get it for us? But
yeah.
Our apparatus committee for the past number of years has, I think, has done a great job. Dave Rees and Fred Plumpton, myself, and we've sat down with other company captains of engine companies and truck companies and said, you know, what do you need? What do you want? What do you want to do different? And usually the three of us sit down and every year, and we say, okay, you know, this is the projection. This is what we think we need. And Fred Plumpton being the first deputy takes it to John Cowan, the chief, and we send John to council to see if he can get us the money.
Well, that to me, there's a couple of concepts in there that you people do, and I'm sure it didn't have anything to do with the fact that some of these things were almost like Bible-type principles that Mike and I have either spoke or written about, but they include such things as with the apparatus committee is to get input, obviously, from you have yourself with Captain Ogden and Chief Reeves at the shop level. You're getting input from the folks, the operational folks that use them on the street, and then obviously involved the fire department administration. But what we've just heard here is not at all unlike what Mike and I have heard from a number of departments throughout the country, both large and small, is that with the impact that our country is experiencing. And it's just not, you know, today we're talking to Captain Dave Ogden, you know, from the Syracuse, New York Fire Department. This is not relegated to just New York State or, you know, the upstate part of New York. If you live down where Brother Mike lives, upstate New York, they think it's the Catskills when you live in the Bronx. Well, you can come up to where Captain Ogden lives in Syracuse, and there's still a lot of upstate New York, you know, north of Syracuse. And this is something that's impacting and all of the departments nationally is cost of inflation and what that has done with the cost of our apparatus and our operating modes that we do, that it's not going to be around with us for a significant period of time. Unfortunately, nobody can crystal ball this and say, no, I think as we stated before, no matter what your political admonitions might be, this is not something relegated that's just going to change if we change presidents next January. Until the dollar, the U.S. dollar strengthens in the world market and we get our economy back up on a more stable basis, we're going to continue to see these explosions in raw materials, and that's just raw, you know, iron ore, a lot of the materials that get involved with building a fire truck, and this all just has consequential impacts all the way down the line to the point where in the past we kind of expected that fire trucks would go up 3.5 to 4% per annum. You know, it's double digit this year, and unfortunately we see this kind of continuing. So we're going to take a break right now. We'd like to thank our sponsor for the Apparatus Architect podcast series, Task Force Tips. And this is Mike Wilbur and Tom Shan, together with our guest today, Captain Dave Ogden from the Syracuse, New York Fire Department. We'll be back in just a few minutes.
Radio at firehouse.com. Real issues, real answers, real firefighters.
TFT has the industry's broadest line of fire suppression equipment, yet everyone thinks we're just nozzles. Sure, we've got all the fixed, selectable, and automatic handheld nozzles you'd ever want, but we also have great foam injection and application equipment, amazing manual and remote control monitors, high-flowing intake valves, and leak-proof suction hose. So if you're specking a new apparatus, go to www.tft.com or give us a call at 800-348-2686. TFT makes over 2,300 products. We're not just nozzles anymore.
Okay, welcome back. This is the Apparatus Architects with Tom Shan and Mike Wilbur. And we have a special guest, right, Tom?
Yep, Captain Dave Ogden from the Syracuse Fire Department. For our listeners, Dave's been on the job there for 30-plus years, with the last 20 as being the assistant superintendent over the apparatus fleet, and we're very fortunate to have Dave and some of his insights to be able to pass along to our listeners today. So we were just chatting during the break. Mike, you wanted to let's discuss that.
I got a question I'd like to throw to the good captain. Rebuilding components versus buying new components as far as apparatus repairs, let's say, for instance, an alternator. What thoughts do you have on that, Dave?
I think it's years ago we did a study, or I did a study, that after a few years in the shops, I wondered why the new apparatus, we never replaced an alternator for the first 3 to 5 years, and then we would take that alternator off and we would put a rebuild alternator on it, and we had that program working that we never used a new alternator. And by keeping records and keeping track of it, I found out that a new alternator on average lasted about a year. So I presented that to my higher ups, and we decided.
You mean a new rebuilt alternator?
Yeah. Or we would have a local vendor rebuild it, or we would buy a rebuilt one from the actual company. And they just didn't last. They lasted maybe a year, maybe 14 months, 16 months, but we weren't getting the lifespan that we got out of a new one. And at the end of our using the rebuilt ones, they were the cost of them to have the labor performed and the shipping for the parts. It was really close, or even not as much as a new one. So we started putting new alternators on everything, and we've cut down from at least having two alternator replacements a week. It's kind of a rarity for us to have to put an alternator in a vehicle now.
You had mentioned during the break something about heat. What kind of heat cooks these, and where is that heat coming from?
The heat, you know, we put these enclosed cabs over the top of these diesel engines, and since the emission controls and these things have just started getting hotter and hotter, and they do that so that they can meet their emission standards. And the new engines are even running a tremendous amount of heat. So the heat from the engine is just encapsulated underneath that cab, and it just cooks that alternator. You know? So even if you replace almost all the parts in it, and I'm not an alternator expert, but I know that we don't replace alternators like we used to. I'm really leery of the 2007 engines to where that alternator is going to be able to withstand that temperature, even though I know all the alternator manufacturers are saying that they can meet that and everything's going to be okay. A few years ago, in the late 90s, we went to remote regulators because we were finding that, you know, the part that burns up first is the regulator, which today in 90% of your alternators is mounted on the alternator. So we went to a remote-mounted regulator, but that still didn't seem to make a difference.
You know, Dave, there's some really good points there. And just for the benefit, again, of some of our listeners who like myself here, are not all that mechanically inclined when it comes to being able to put A and B together and make it work. When we hear just about technology in general, what's changing with diesel engines, and there still is some sentiment out there that people don't clearly understand that with what changed in 2007 with the increasing heat rejection, meaning heat coming off the motor, just not only ambient heat, but the cooling requirements that those 2007 EPA-compliant engines required, was one of the reasons why just about everybody in the fire truck market had to re-engineer their cabs to accept the cooling package, the radiator, and everything that was going to be necessary to make this engine work in a custom chassis fire truck. And although Mike and I have spoke to this issue previously, it bears repeating in that when people say, well, so-and-so's branded engine, they say it's compliant and it's certified. You know, that means it meets the government criteria, but that's a raw engine sitting in a crate on somebody's manufacturing floor. The fire apparatus manufacturers, those chassis engineers individually have to work to make that engine, A, physically fit in the cabin chassis, and then to design a cooling package to make the engine cool. And then, as Captain Ogden just mentioned, now you have to put on all the accessories. You've got to put on the air compressor drives. You're running the exhaust system, which now you can't modify and change. You've got to get room for the turbocharger, or in some cases, the dual turbochargers, and in a lot of cases, the alternator, which is a very important part of the product for what we need in the fire service. That's an accessory item that people then look at the engine packaging and saying, okay, what do we got room left, you know, to go put this in there? And in the meantime, the ambient heat off the motor, as well as the fact that now these engine enclosures are super insulated. Dave, I can remember the first batch of four-door cabs that Syracuse got in the late 80s with the KME units that, as I recall, the tread plate, it was just an aluminum tread plate enclosure that would have been in a canopy cab, and now it's enclosed in a four-door cab, and it's great if you're there in, you know, January or February. It's a great little heat sink to stay warm in the middle of July. You know, we're not only cooking the engine components and the alternator that we were just talking about, we're also cooking the personnel back there because it's hot as heck. And now
I remember Tom getting burnt inside one of those as a fireman riding around in 56 truck in an 81 Seagrave. You had to put your bunker coat. Make sure you had your bunker coat on, or if it was hot in the summertime, just driving to do building inspection or to get a meal, you had to put your coat over that tread plate, or you'd burn your arm.
Yeah, and that was one of the probably cottage industries that was short-lived and then kind of went away. But, again, somewhat showing our age here between Michael, Tom, and Dave, that there was a time where there was actually companies that produced, they called them engine blankets. You know, kind of like a blanket you put over an animal outside to keep, you know, keep the heat contained within your horse. There were people that had these super insulated engine blankets that were designed to keep the heat coming off the motor that would then just turn the aluminum tread plate or whatever your engine box is made out of into a giant heat sink, would keep that from a little bit of that heat from coming up into the cab, but to keep it safe for the personnel riding in the back there. So you look, we've kind of come full cycle where we've solved, you know, some problems, and then as Dave discussed, in a lot of cases now we've created some other issues. So one of the other things we wanted to discuss with Dave today, Syracuse is, again, it's somewhat of a unique municipality in that with their engine companies historically dating back to 1972 when they bought the first two of these maxi pumpers that were equipped with two-section telescopic water towers, a trade name that people sometimes were called as a telescope, even though they may have been made, you know, by other manufacturers that used other trademark names. But Syracuse is somewhat unique in that since 72, their entire engine company fleet has always been outfitted with these water tower devices. Now, so I guess two things, Dave, with your experience both in the field and then now for the last several years in the shops, what impact has that had on some of the firefighting capabilities that the Syracuse Fire Department has faced over the period of years? And by the addition of that, now basically having a little mini aerial device on every one of your pieces of apparatus, has that done anything to dramatically change or increase your maintenance costs when you're looking at that type of unit?
Tactically, it works for us because we have all of our engines have this 55-foot water tower on it that we have a numerous amount of those large 2.5-story balloon frame construction houses or old heavy timber factory buildings, and it just allows us to surround it and pound it. We have a super municipal water system here that we can supply all these pumpers off of all the hydrants in our just around the building without making pressure drops throughout the city. So we have the water capabilities. So the telesquirt, though, I don't think whether it was a telesquirt or a Ready Techmatic or a snorkel or an LTI, whatever it was, you're right, we do call them telesquirts, but gives us the ability to just to hit it. We can just pound the fire in. And I suppose that saves maintenance-wise because we're not sitting there for 2 or 3 days trying to put out a structure, because we can just get the water up and with the high streams or the telesquirts and with the soften aerials, we can really throw some water at a fire, get it to go out quicker. So I guess we go back into service. The vehicle isn't sitting out in the street pounding for running at its maximum for 2 or 3 days. Maintenance-wise, all of our soften aerial platforms are 1,500 gallon a minute pumpers, and all of our 2,000 gallon a minute pumpers are aerials. So I was never there. I guess I've been there 20 years. I wasn't there before that. But, you know, it's everything's an aerial and everything's a pumper, so that's a big part of the fleet, big part of maintenance, getting your third-party inspections every year, so everything has to have a pump test, everything has to have a third-party aerial inspection. All of our aerials are steam cleaned and re-lubed and re-torqued at least once a year. That's an ongoing program.
I have a question for you, Dave. Not to interrupt, but are your maintenance folks, are they certified to do the aerial and pump tests, or do you go out to a third-party testing facility for that work?
The aerial testing is done by a third party. I believe that would be the cleanest. I think that that is worth every penny that it cost us to have them done by a third party, somebody that's not interested in overlooking something because they have to end up doing the repair. Not that anybody would, but you know, the tendency is if you got to fix it, maybe you aren't going to find it as often. The pump tests for 20 years, I've done them all. So, and I don't have to physically put my hand on a wrench and fix it. So we found a lot of problems over the years. I personally do them all, and so I'm pretty, it gives me, I get to see every vehicle at least once a year up close and personal. So.
Dave, with the fact that Syracuse has a strong municipal water system, and you've got these, you know, high volume 2,000 GPM pumps, so maybe unlike some of the other locales where it's they're doing a combination of their firefighting tactics, so in some cases they're drawing off a hydrant system, and in other cases they're in a rural water supply, where the quality of the water, not from a health or drinking perspective, but the quality of the water that they may be drafting or getting can do some damage to the pumps. Is there any particular component that you've noticed that is something that wears out frequently or that has been a constant source of, after you do the pump test, you can almost write it up and know that you're going to have to go in and go touch that item? It seems like, you know, most common things, people always complaining about the, you know, ball valves are scored or their tank, the pump valve is leaking. Mike and I were in a community a couple of weeks ago where, you know, it seemed like half of the pumpers looked like, the, you know, it was pretty clear that, you know, they needed to have the packing adjusted or there was water leaking all over the floor. And in that locale, they all relied upon it was a rural water supply situation, so the quality of the water left a lot to be desired. But in your situation, anything in particular that you've seen that's a constant source of maintenance or upkeep that you've just noted from year to year?
In Syracuse, we have the same water in our hydrant system as we do for drinking, and the water comes out of a lake here that is one of the cleanest in the nation. So when it comes out of that lake, it's pretty clear and pure water. After it runs through the water mains, I think it picks up a little iron. So, yeah, we get some scoring of the ball valves and the packings. That's a good one to find every year, you know. And over the years, the guys are more aware of it. So before it gets that bad, they're calling and saying, "Hey, I think you know we're leaking a little bit too much." Or freeze damage here in the Northeast. Some drain valves that are cracked. Actual water piping that's cracked that maybe got a little too cold last winter that they don't normally use. Our hydrants have an average of about 65 pounds in them, and they go from 40 to 100-pound hydrants. So I got a fleet of pump operators that ride around with the tank to pump valve open. So when it comes time to shut that off, and that's difficult. And it gets scored from the water and the deposits in the water.
Yeah, a lot of people... A lot of people would think of upstate New York if they hear Syracuse, or certainly where I live out in Buffalo, and if, you know, if they don't know anything else about the area, the first comment is that must be a tough area, you know, tough climate to be in the wintertime. Is there anything from a component standpoint, Dave, that you people specify on your apparatus to over and above what people might consider as a normal item to protect the pump and the plumbing or anything like that during the extremely cold weather or the gauges? Have you done anything in particular there, or is it pretty much standard componentry that you use?
No, we spec the sub-zero gauges, but then we also spec the panel gauge heater, and where each gauge and gauge line is wrapped with a heat tape that's controlled by a thermostat on the pump panel. And we test those every time we get them into the shop. But the important part of that is on a mid-build or a final inspection at the OEM, that those heat tapes have to be wrapped correctly and all the way to the gauge, or we're going to have problems down the line. And if they put that pump enclosure into the chassis before and and didn't wrap them sufficiently, then we could have trouble for years. We've just started speccing our engines with a plate or a square piece of metal that slides on tracks underneath the pump enclosure to incorporate trapping some heat coming off of the underneath the cab back into the pump enclosure because of the American LaFrance apparatus that we have been getting. When the cab comes down, it pretty well cuts the pump enclosure off the way that it's constructed, where historically, once the cab comes down or before we had tilt cabs, it was pretty open from the engine back into the pump enclosure, and we seemed to make out better in the winter then. We didn't have a problem. Now with the newer apparatus where it's a prefabricated on-the-floor pump enclosure, and then it's set on the chassis rails, and then the cab comes down and protects it from the elements, but there's no that radiant heat that comes off of the engine to go back there, and so we've frozen up some plumbing.
Well, that's good information as well. Again, the listeners come from all different geographic parts of the country, and where some people are more concerned about, you know, the adverse impacts if you're down in the desert southwest. I always joke with folks, if you were in the Phoenix, Arizona area and stopped into a fire station and asked them how their rig was, and Mike, you'll appreciate this, you can just go ask the average engine guy anywhere down in the southwestern desert area, said, what do you think of your fire truck? My joke is that they always rated it based on three things. One was how good the refrigeration was. That was their local terminology for air conditioning. If you had good refrigeration in the cab, that got you one thumb up. The second thing was, because many departments down there with the high number of EMS calls they run and the low incident of fires as compared to in Syracuse or in FDNY, many departments in that area do not run SCBAs in the cab. They're running the compartments. So the second thing that the average firefighter would grade the apparatus on is how comfortable that seat was, because he wasn't looking at, you know, getting in and out of it with his SCBA. And the third thing, which I always thought was pretty funny, but if you've ever been down in that area in the Phoenix or out in the Palm Springs area, anywhere in the high desert of California in the summertime when it gets to be above 105 or 110 and they say stay hydrated, they mean it. So the third thing was how good the cup holders were inside the cab. So three things that probably, other than the few hot days we get up here in upstate New York, the brothers in Syracuse would like to have the air conditioning. I haven't ever had anybody in my years there, you know, tell me that it was a comfortable seat or they like the cup holders. But if you're in Phoenix, Arizona, that's how you're grading your fire truck. So next thing is, let's talk a little bit about, you know, some of our listeners may be confused because we briefly talked about what the mini pumper fleet was in Syracuse. Initially was that small cab and chassis, and over the years the cabs and chassis got physically a little bit bigger. I think as Dave can speak to, they went from the smaller internationals that had the vacuum hydraulic brakes that, and many days those things you needed them. I'm sure you probably put brakes on those things pretty frequently. That would have been better off if they would have been equipped with a little parachute on the or anchor on the back. And the chassis got bigger. The engine and the power plants went from gasoline to diesel and got a little bit bigger. But the firefighting package, other than the water tank getting a little bigger over years, up to 300 gallons, you kind of came full circle, and now you mentioned about first response units. So, Dave, if you could maybe just talk a little bit about with Syracuse, why they made that move from the mini pumper that actually had some firefighting capability to go to what you're operating today with these first response units that are assigned to the engine companies, and how you deploy and operate them, and finally, you know, what impact that has had, and you know, with your maintenance capabilities, you know, to keep those things out on the street.
Yeah, back then when we had the small international chassis with the hydraulic, maybe it'll stop next week package on it, they weren't sufficient. Their original purpose was that they could maybe go into a parking garage, or they could go to a car fire, or they could go in the basement of something. But as all fire apparatus and, you know, the what-if concept came in that we wanted to start adding stuff. And so as they added stuff, the chassis became too small to carry what they wanted to carry. And I think actually International eliminated that chassis. So we bumped up to the 4800 chassis, which gave us all the big truck features, the air brakes, the diesel engine, but we remained still at a 250-gallon pump with a 300-gallon booster tank, and we can now carry 700 feet of 4-inch hose. But it also grew so big that it no longer fulfilled its original mission. It was too big to go in a parking garage. When they took it, it would trail the engine on a structured dispatch, and it got to be so big that it was in the way. So now they were parking them down the street, in the around the blocks, in somebody's driveway, just to try and get them out, away from the rest of the incoming traffic. The manifold that was on them, they had the deck gun on them, and they could theoretically take this and put a supply under the front, into the pumper, the 2,000-gallon in a pumper, drive down the street or around the corner, out in the backyard, and pump from the pumper through the manifold through that Santa Rosa deck gun. Worked until the vehicle became too big to go down driveways and stuff, but now it was a safe vehicle. It was also a midi pumper. It would have been a Class A pumper, except for it only had a 250-gallon tank or a pump on there. And many a manufacturer says, well, why don't you put a 750 pump on it, and you can call it a Class A pumper. Well, we got something that are Class A pumpers, and we got pumpers that are Class A pumpers. We didn't need any more pumpers. Back in 1993 or 2, somewhere in that area, the chief of the fire at the time, Chief Downs, came to me and said, well, we see what we can come up with by going back to like a straight pickup truck chassis with some kind of a service body on the back of it. And so we did. In 1994, we put this little mini pumper or first response vehicle out, and it was just going to do medical calls, and then we would be able to relieve our mini fleet down to this. And then political changes happened, and it stayed out there till about 2000. It was used in different capacities for a hazmat company, used it for a while. The rescue company used it for a while. And then when I believe it was Chief Cummings came in, and they decided, well, you know, it's time that we have to replace these Internationals, but we don't. The cost became so prohibitive to buy another 7 or 8 of these what had become midi pumpers. So we decided to go into the mini, or as we call them now, a first response vehicle. And we use a Ford F-350 chassis and a fiberglass service body on the back. And they've worked out very well for us. So although we still carry some water, some hose on it, we carry no water, but we do carry a couple hundred, I think 400 feet of 4-inch hose, and a couple hundred feet of 1¾-inch hand line, and a task force nozzle, just in case they're coming back from someplace, and can do something. One of the things that also eliminated the MIDI pumper was the change of the tactical rules with the 2-in and 2-out mandatory SCBA use, and we're not going to use a booster line on a car fire anymore. So that was really the final nail in the MIDI pumper's demise. Now they go mostly on medical calls, and first engine on the full telephone leaves theirs in quarters. Fleet maintenance-wise, it was a surprise. We, due to budgetary cuts at that point, were unable to replace one of our maintenance technicians. And at the same time, we started to implement these new first response vehicles. Even myself didn't realize how much maintenance was involved, that this was a whole other fleet of 9 pumpers that required all that maintenance. But that was a vehicle that was not intended to be what it was. And so maintenance is always greater on a vehicle. If you take a single certain vehicle and you overload it, or you're trying to make it do something that it wasn't engineered or designed to do, or it's one of a kind, maintenance is always as heavy on that.
Dave, with the first response vehicles now, say as compared to the preventative maintenance schedule for those smaller units, as compared to like the PM schedule on one of the large maxi pumpers. If you take one of your busier running companies, like engine two up on the north side, or engine seven in the university area, at what mileage interval do you bring the first response unit in to just do a general PM check, servicing and stuff, as compared to the big engine that's in quarters?
We'll bring the first response vehicle in 3 to 4 times a year, like a quarterly, even in a busy company. And they don't put that many miles on them. This isn't that big a municipality. We're only 25 or 30 square miles, so at the end of 3 months, they're probably putting on about 4,000 miles. The maxi pumpers and the Suffins come in on a calendar year, and we keep them for maybe 2 to 3 weeks and go through them from stem, from front to back, wheel ends, pump. So once I get it, I'll keep it for 2 or 3 weeks. My guys will go through it. We'll do all the repairs on it, and historically, we won't see that again unless there's a catastrophic breakdown of something until the following PM. So we keep them for quite a while in PM. We spend a lot of man hours going through it, but when it goes back to quarters, it stays there for hopefully another 11 months until we see it again.
Okay. During that time when it goes down, this is interesting, your concept here, Dave, but when it comes into the shop for the annual PM, is that also the time when you're going to do the pump test and would do the aerial device test, or are those things done at a different point in the year?
Yeah, those things are done at a different time of the year. Those things historically are done starting right after Labor Day, and we'll finish all of that process probably right around Thanksgiving time, all the pump tests and the aerial tests and the aerial washing and PM will be done in the fall. The mini, the first response vehicles, they're only in the shop for a day.
It seems like you have a philosophy there, Dave, that many fleet managers do. It's better to spend time and money on the front end and spend less time and less money than it is to wait for it to have a catastrophic failure, and then you're really behind the eight ball and playing catch up.
Yeah, I think when I took this job a number of years ago, I said that my friend's riding on these trucks, and I've been there. So the last thing I want to be is the pump operator in front of a burning building and have a problem. And that's the last thing I want for them to have happen.
Mike, Dave's philosophy there, which, with all of his years of experience, both, on the line as well as in the shops, is kind of an interesting contrast to what you and I have heard with some of the folks that come up to us, particularly when we're doing presentations at the shows, and they'll talk about their, justifiably proud of their frontline unit, and then we'll ask them about, what their experiences or what their city's reserve fleet is like, and it's been more than a couple of times the comments have come back and the folks have said, we can have 2 or 3 maybe unrelated problems with the frontline rig, and when we call the shops and say, when can we schedule to get the rig in to get these things fixed, their advice is, more often than not, you might want to keep running that, because either A, we have no reserve units, or the reserve unit that we're about to give you is held together with, True Value Bob's bubble gum and baling wire, and what you're running, as bad as it might be, is still better than what we're going to give you to run in.
Yeah, I was actually told that one time when I was driving a 56 truck and had a brake issue. It was a Sunday night. There was one mechanic, and I was the 17th call. And, he said, you can either run that one or you can go get a spare, and I guarantee you the reserve piece you're going to get, that spare unit is going to be worse than what you have, so it's your choice.
Unfortunately, yeah, I think that's you know, monetarily, and that's something that a lot of departments live with. You know, if you have something to go into, if it's not as good as the thing you came out to, or at least the safe, then there's no sense in changing into it. But you can't ride on something that the brakes are no good on, or that the fire pump doesn't work. That's just criminal.
There's a lot to be said for departments that have a documented, planned out fleet replacement program, as Captain Ogden had spoke about. And Syracuse, for a medium sized city of 10 engines, 6 ladder companies, and a rescue company with a whole bunch of specialized and support units, for a number of years they've had the program. So not only do they have the ability to ride in good, well-maintained, well-designed quality apparatus up on the front side, when you go into a spare or a reserve unit, at least with the majority of their engine fleet, you're coming out of a four-door cab rig that's a 2,000 GPM pump, got 4 crosslays, split beds, a 4-inch, and a water tower boom. You're going into something that's a couple years older, but is set up exactly the same way. And unfortunately, you can see in a lot of cities, and what Mike and I see coming down the road, is that as people defer their apparatus purchases for whatever reason, cost avoidance, or, there's a year we've had, some departments tell us that, it's a contract year in the city for the different, unions between police and fire. So the choice is, everybody's going to get a raise, or we're going to get a new fire truck, or replace apparatus. And with the impact of inflation, I think we're unfortunately going to see a lot more of that. So we've been very, very fortunate here to have Captain Dave Ogden from the Syracuse, New York Fire Department to be our guest today to speak on a lot of just hands-on topics with respect to what it takes to maintain a modern-day fleet of apparatus, and all the good, bad, and indifferent that go along with that. So, Captain, any final thoughts or anything you'd like to pass along to our listeners today?
No, I'm just happy to be with you and Mike. And I think one of the things that came out of our five-year plan is that our politicians just don't like to be surprised. So that if you can tell them, that this is what we want to do this year, this is what we want to do next year, and the year after that, and year after that, and year after that, and they can actually take that home and look at it, and then next year comes along, you say, I know it's contract year, but remember, this is what we were going to ask for, and they go, they seem to be more conducive to that. But that's the best thing I think that's come out of that five-year plan for us.
Yeah, I think very very good advice. If you look at Dave, in your 20-year career of working in the shops, think of how many different take mayors or people in any kind of political venue that have gone through. Your jobs remain constant in terms of what you're responsible for, but the number of people that you're trying to, quote, sell the program to can conceivably, in the political circles, can change up every couple of years, and it's a continuing education process. So for our listeners, I think it's one of the things that I liked on a recent program that I watch, a television program, at the end of the show, they say, what did we learn today? And I think because of the good captain, one of the things hopefully that our listeners have picked up on is some, not only some maintenance tips, but as well as some things. If you don't have an apparatus replacement plan, it would be time to get a couple people behind closed doors, kind of like what Syracuse has done, even if you want to, model it after what they have accomplished by taking people from the maintenance side of the house, taking people from the operation side, from the folks that actually ride the apparatus, and wind that into your administration, so you get a three-prong approach of developing the plan, and then it does take some legwork and horsepower and a little bit of your administrative time to go sell it to the politicians. But as Dave just mentioned, politicians don't like to be surprised. And in the city of Syracuse, where you're dealing with a multi-million dollar budget, you would think that a $500,000 or $600,000 fire truck or $1 million aerial device might not be a big ticket. but it really is. And in a lot of smaller communities, even if your administration oversees other groups or organizations like the Department of Public Works, there's a good chance if you're going to buy some kind of aerial device or a rescue engine or some type of combination rescue vehicle, it very well can be the most expensive six-tired thing that this community's ever going to buy, and you start floating numbers past them that you're comfortable with because you've talked to two or three vendors and everybody's telling you, yeah, this is going to take $650,000 to do it. And then you go in front of your little village board or your administration and say you need $650K to get a new fire truck, and you get a lot of blank stares. You can tell you probably should have done a little bit of preliminary groundwork there. So excellent advice and information. Again, we'd like to thank Captain Dave Ogden from the Syracuse, New York Fire Department. And, Michael, any parting thoughts before we wrap up for the day?
Yeah, Tom, I'd just like to concur with the captain. I think the days of going out to the apparatus bay and saying, it's looking a little rusty, it's 20 years old, we'll go to the political entity and we're going to ask them for a truck. And, you know, and then we go in and, like the captain said, you know, you actually surprise them. And, you know, oh, by the way, next year we need, you know, $500,000 to replace this pump. I think those days are gone forever. If you don't have a 20-year apparatus capital improvement replacement plan, I think that you need to revisit that issue for sure. And the other point that he made that I think as the cost of apparatus escalates is just deferred maintenance. This is a pay me now, pay me later kind of business, and you can either pay a little bit of money up front and do it right, or if you try to defer things, you're going to pay later on, and it's going to be, you know, 5 or 10 times that amount of money to try and make it right on the back end. So I think to defer anything is just, again, penny wise but pound foolish. So we'll throw it back to you, Tom.
Yeah, well, again, we'd like to thank Captain Dave Ogden from the Syracuse, New York Fire Department, and we'll be looking to have in future podcasts, we'll be talking a little bit more to expound on some of our discussions today. And this is Mike Wilbur and Tom Shands. Thank you very much for listening in to this edition of the Apparatus Architects, brought to you at firehouse.com. And once again, I'd like to thank our sponsor, Task Force Tips, for their kind assistance in being able to promote our program. Until the next time, please, brother and sister firefighters, stay well and stay safe.
If you have a comment on this program, drop us a line at radio@firehouse.com. Thanks for listening. And stay tuned to firehouse.com for more broadcasts like these. Or visit our website at www.firehouse.com/radio.